This show was produced on March 14, 2016.
On March 8th, a 47-year-old Brazilian construction tycoon was sentenced to 19 years in prison for corruption and money laundering in a widening scandal involving the Brazilian state oil company Petrobras. On March 4th, a task force of 300 federal police and 36 auditors raided the home and other properties belonging to former Brazilian President Ignacio Lula da Silva, who was detained for questioning by police for 3 hours. On March 10th, the Colombian foreign minister announced that his government and the Colombian Revolutionary Armed Forces, known by their Spanish acronym as the FARC, had come to an agreement on the final points of a peace treaty. Colombian foreign minister Juan Fernando Cristo said that the peace negotiators would make an important announcement on March 23rd. We'll report on developments in the peace process and on a fact-finding mission to Colombia by the non-governmental Washington Office on Latin America. Colombian unions and social justice movements are planning a massive work stoppage for March 17th to protest high inflation and other issues. On this show, we'll report on President Obama's renewed declaration that Venezuela's socialist government is a threat to U.S. national security, and on apparent efforts by the new conservative majority in the Venezuelan legislature to remove the elected president, Nicolas Maduro, from office. We'll also report on an online campaign to provide support for the family and co-workers of slain Honduran indigenous environmentalist Berta Cáceres, and on efforts to demand that the Honduran government allow the Mexican environmentalist Gustavo Castro, who survived the attack, to return to Mexico. In addition, we've got an update on the 2-month-long incarceration of a popular grassroots organizer in Argentina and on President Obama's upcoming visit to the South American country on the 40th anniversary of the military coup that began the 7-year-long dirty war against leftists. President Obama will visit Cuba on March 21st and 22nd. The Cuban Grama News Service recently published an editorial insisting that the U.S. must end its policy of seeking regime change on the island nation, noting that it would never abandon its socialist principles. A Chilean doctor, who found asylum in Mexico after fleeing the U.S.-supported Pinochet dictatorship, was murdered at his clinic. We'll report on his killing and on recent developments in the investigation of the massacre of 72 Central American migrants in northern Mexico in 2010.
President Barack Obama will visit Cuba on March 21st and 22nd. It will be the first visit to Cuba by a sitting U.S. president in nearly 90 years. President Obama will then fly to Argentina to meet with newly elected conservative President Mauricio Macri on March 23rd and 24th. Obama will arrive in Argentina on the eve of the 40th anniversary of the 1976 military coup that established a 7-year-long military dictatorship. We'll report on President Obama's visit to Cuba and Argentina, as well as on the grassroots protests expected during his visit on our next show. More information on the 7-year-long Argentine Dirty War and on the U.S. role in supporting it is posted by the non-governmental National Security Archive at nsarchive.org.
La Lucha Sigue reported extensively on Berta Cáceres and on the Council of Honduran, Indigenous, and Popular Organizations, known by its Spanish acronym as COPIN, prior to Berta's assassination. Since that time, almost the entirety of the English-language media have reported on her despite the fact that she was largely ignored while she was alive. Because of the widespread recent coverage, we're only going to report on a North American-based campaign to support the surviving eyewitness to the attack, the surviving Cáceres family, and COPIN, the organization that Cáceres founded in 1993.
The surviving eyewitness who was wounded in the attack, Gustavo Castro Soto, remains in the effective custody of Honduran authorities because he is not allowed to leave Honduras. Castro Soto attempted to fly home to his family in Mexico after giving his testimony to the Honduran authorities, but he was prevented from leaving the country by officials at the airport. Castro Soto has since been given refuge at the Mexican embassy in the Honduran capital of Tegucigalpa. The surviving Cáceres family is in urgent need of funds as they respond to the crisis. They have not only the expenses related to Berta's death, but also the need to improve security measures such as closed-circuit cameras in certain homes, buying new cell phones, reinforcing doors and windows, making travel plans, and conducting an independent investigation. The COPIN organization also needs to reinforce its security, to install video cameras, and to take most of the same precautionary measures as the Cáceres family. Rights Action has organized a campaign to raise funds for the Cáceres family and for COPIN. In addition, Rights Action has posted an online campaign to demand that the Honduran government allow Gustavo Castro Soto to return to his family. More information on the campaigns to support the Cáceres family, COPIN, and to allow Gustavo Castro Soto to return to his family in Mexico is posted at rightsaction.org. That's rightsaction.org.
On February 28th, in the central Mexican city of Cotitlán Izcalli, unknown assailants murdered a 68-year-old Chilean doctor who found refuge in Mexico after escaping persecution by the Augusto Pinochet dictatorship in Chile in the 1970s. Dr. Venancio Queupumil formally received political asylum status in Mexico in 1987. Witnesses said that Dr. Queupumil, an indigenous Mapuche who belonged to the Chilean Communist Party and who trained to be a doctor in Cuba, was killed by three young men who pretended that one of them needed medical attention.
According to Queupumil's unnamed 23-year-old daughter, the assailants arrived at the doctor's clinic at 6 in the morning in two cars that were driven by two other men who remained outside. A nurse who assisted the slain doctor said that one of the young men asked him, "Did you really think that we couldn't get into your house?" before shooting and killing him. The group of three left the clinic and were taken away in the two cars that waited for them in front of the doctor's offices. When the doctor's family tried to review video recordings from a commercial closed-circuit security system provider, they discovered that the cameras had not functioned for 2 months, raising concerns that the security company had collaborated in the doctor's killing. No valuables were taken from the victim's medical clinic. Dr. Queupumil had recently retired from the Mexican Institute of Social Security. He dedicated himself to working in the small clinic that he had established on his own property.
On March 2nd, the Mexican Supreme Court ordered the Federal Attorney General to investigate the massacre of 72 Central American migrants that occurred in northeastern Mexico near the Texas border nearly 6 years ago. Relatives of the victims have complained that local and state investigations were flawed and that the Tamaulipas state government has done little to resolve the case. The massacre occurred in August of 2010 when 58 men and 14 women from Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Ecuador, and Brazil were killed, supposedly as they attempted to travel north to the U.S.
The remains of the migrants were found in 2011 in several mass graves in the rural San Fernando municipality in Tamaulipas, the Mexican state that borders Texas where the Rio Grande empties into the sea. Local authorities theorized that the Zetas drug cartel was involved in the massacre, but no suspects have been named or arrested. The Supreme Court also ruled that two Salvadoran women, Vertilia Parada and Alma Releagueño, who are relatives of two of the dead, be recognized before the law as victims of the crime. The decision grants Parada and Releagueño legal rights to reparations as well as access to investigative files and to experts working on the case. Although only two of the relatives of the 72 murdered migrants have been granted special victim status by the Supreme Court, the decision sets a precedent for the surviving relatives of the other victims. At least 16 relatives of other victims have been registered with Mexico's National Registry of Victims. Amnesty International said that lack of progress in the San Fernando case demonstrates the Mexican government's negligence in dealing with the country's deep human rights crisis.
In early March, the Frontera Norte Sur News Service posted a comprehensive report on the Mexican government investigation into the still unsolved disappearance of 43 student teachers and killing of six other persons in September of 2014. Three students from the teachers' college in the town of Ayotzinapa in the southwestern state of Guerrero and three other individuals were killed when police and civilian gunmen opened fire on buses full of students and youth. One of the buses, in which the driver and a 15-year-old soccer player were killed, carried a teenage soccer team, not student teachers.
According to the mother of the young soccer player, his team's bus was painted with its team's logo, making it impossible for the bus to be mistaken for the local buses that carried the Ayotzinapa students. The complete report on the Ayotzinapa killings and disappearances is posted by the Frontera Norte Sur News Service of the Center for Latin American and Border Studies at New Mexico University at fnsnews.nmsu.org. Or search Norte Sur News.
The Colombian government and the leftist Colombian rebel armed forces, known by their Spanish acronym as the FARC, have apparently overcome obstacles that threatened to delay the scheduled March 23rd signing of peace accords to end over a half century of warfare. One of the most recent developments in the peace negotiations is an agreement between the government and the rebels that prohibits journalists from contacting FARC representatives who are in Colombia to explain the pending treaty to rebel combatants. The rebels also agreed to not hold events that include civilian non-combatants or the media. Various rebel negotiators are visiting FARC units within Colombia to ensure that insurgent troops are comprehensively informed in order to avoid misunderstandings during the transition to civilian life. The government is responsible for promoting the peace treaty among the civilian population.
The ban was implemented after many news sources published reports of FARC lead negotiator Ivan Marquez and other FARC leaders visiting the northern Colombian department of La Guajira. During the trip, Marquez was photographed surrounded by hundreds of armed guerrillas at a public event in a remote village. On March 2nd, the Colombian Interior Minister, Juan Fernando Cristo, said that government and rebel negotiators had agreed to prohibit FARC representatives from having contact with civilians or with the media. Journalists and free press advocates have protested the restrictions, noting that they have never been prohibited from speaking to the guerrillas. The non-governmental Colombian Foundation for Press Freedom asserted that the prohibition is illegal because, quote, it doesn't fulfill the required criteria regarding legality, necessity, and proportionality, end quote. The Independent Columbia Reports news service announced that it would ignore the ban on reporting on FARC leaders' visits with their troops, asserting that if they comply, they would make themselves vulnerable to censorship in the future. Colombian Interior Minister Cristo has responded to complaints and inquiries from journalists by saying that the only party that should comply with the ban is the FARC, not the press. Columbia Reports challenged the Interior Minister's statement by asking why the government had also prohibited regional, national, and international news media from attending or reporting on the FARC's informational meetings with its troops and supporters.
Colombian government and FARC peace negotiators have been meeting in Havana since 2012 in an effort to end the civil war. The war, which began in 1964, has resulted in some 300,000 deaths and an unknown total who have been maimed and injured. At least 6 million people have been displaced by fighting between the leftist insurgency, government troops, and right-wing paramilitaries.
In February, the Washington Office on Latin America, known by its English acronym as WOLA, sent a fact-finding mission to Colombia to meet with a cross-section of Colombian society to discuss the end of the civil war. WOLA sought to evaluate how the international community can help during the period of instability after the insurgents disarm. A WOLA representative, Jimena Sanchez, said that the group's researchers found an increase in killings, threats, repression, and criminalization of human rights advocates by state security forces. She noted that civil society is being effectively censored at a point in the peace process when it is especially important for the citizenry to express itself. Sanchez also described concerns about the lack of peace talks with Colombia's second-largest insurgent guerrilla force, the National Liberation Army, known by its Spanish initials as the ELN. She said that the U.S. has urged that Colombia's ethnic and indigenous groups be included in the peace process, noting that most of the funds in the U.S.'s so-called Peace Colombia plan should be directed to civil society because it is they who will actually construct a peaceful democracy. The Colombian government insists on handling all of the funds.
Sanchez said that this is troubling because of widespread government corruption. The research group's fieldwork also indicated that criminal paramilitary groups will try to take advantage of the vacuum of power that will be created when the insurgent forces disarm and demobilize. Sanchez said that the Colombian government claims that paramilitary groups no longer exist. She said that the most Afro-Colombian Western Colombian Department of Chocó is especially vulnerable to a paramilitary surge. Sanchez noted that the Urabeños have doubled their territory and settled in areas previously under rebel control in the 4 years that the FARC has limited its operations during the peace negotiations.
On March 2nd, Colombian officials reported that over 200 people, mostly Afro-Colombians, left their homes in the southwestern department of Nariño after recent clashes between FARC guerrillas and the paramilitary criminal organization known as Los Urabeños. The displacements began in mid-February when nearly 150 residents of the Alto Jagua village relocated to the southwestern coastal town of Tumaco. On March 1st, another 30 families from Alto Jagua, between 90 to 150 persons, fled to Tumaco, where an unnamed NGO distributes food and other necessities to displaced families. In late February, at least 400 persons were displaced by an incursion of Urabeños forces into territory controlled by Colombia's second-largest leftist rebel army, the National Liberation Army, known by its Spanish initials as the ELN. Another 3,000 persons in the mostly Afro-Colombian populated Chocó region in western Colombia were suffering a humanitarian emergency. The Urabeños began an offensive in Colombia's Pacific region a few weeks before the scheduled March 23rd signing of the peace accords between the government and the FARC, raising concerns that the offensive is intended to sabotage the peace talks.
Colombia's most high-profile opponent of the government's peace negotiations with the FARC, former President Álvaro Uribe, has been linked to the right-wing paramilitaries since he began his political career in the northwestern state of Antioquia in the 1980s. The former president's younger brother, Santiago Uribe, was arrested on February 29th in the exclusive El Poblado neighborhood in Medellín, the Antioquia departmental capital, on charges related to organizing and leading a paramilitary group in the 1990s. Santiago is accused of aggravated homicide and of criminal conspiracy, while he led the so-called 12 Apostles organization, which is linked to dozens of forced disappearances and murders.
The 12 Apostles group was most active in the Antioquia department, where Santiago's brother Álvaro was governor before he was elected president of Colombia for 2 4-year terms from 2002 until 2010. The main witness in the case is a former police major, Juan Carlos Meneses, who testified that Santiago Uribe operated the 12 Apostles group with the complicity of local police officials. Ex-President Álvaro Uribe has been linked to numerous other scandals and allegations of corruption. In 2011, former President Uribe's former agriculture minister, Andrés Arias, was arrested on corruption, and two of the former president's top officials were sentenced last year for participating in a wiretapping scandal. Uribe's cousin, Mario, was arrested in 2008 as part of the parapolitics scandal in which dozens of politicians were linked to paramilitary groups. The former president's sister-in-law was extradited to the U.S. for drug trafficking and money laundering in 2012.
Members of Venezuela's ruling United Socialist Party have expressed growing concern that the right-wing majority in the Legislative Assembly is preparing to attempt an overthrow of democratically elected leftist president Nicolás Maduro. In 2012, Paraguay's elected reformist president, Fernando Lugo, was impeached by a conservative legislative majority. In 2009, the elected Honduran reformist president Manuel Zelaya was deposed by a conservative majority in the Supreme Court, who ordered the armed forces to remove him from office. Zelaya was accused of exceeding his authority for organizing a non-binding referendum to evaluate public support for constitutional reforms.
On March 3rd, President Barack Obama extended for another year his declaration claiming that Venezuela is a threat to U.S. national security and that Venezuela's elected socialist government systematically violates human rights. President Obama initially issued an executive order against Venezuela in March of 2015 and ordered sanctions then against 7 Venezuelan government officials over allegations of drug trafficking and other charges. In renewing the measure this year, Obama said that he was declaring a national emergency because Venezuela constitutes, quote, an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States, end quote. But on April 9th, 2015, 1 month after his first declaration of Venezuela being a threat to U.S. national security, Obama told the EFE News Service, quote, "We do not believe that Venezuela poses a threat to the United States, nor does the United States threaten the Venezuelan government," end quote. At that time, the U.S. president was trying to quiet the backlash throughout Latin America that erupted after his national emergency declaration in the days before he attended the OAS Summit of the Americas. Nevertheless, Obama did not rescind the measure, even though it was condemned by every Latin American nation. At the time, U.S. Subsecretary of State for Latin America, Roberta Jacobson, said that she was disappointed that more nations did not support Obama's declaration, adding, quote, "It was not made to harm Venezuelans or the Venezuelan government," end quote.
In early March, Colombian officials reported that smuggling of contraband along Colombia's border with Venezuela had dropped significantly after the Venezuelan government closed various border crossings 6 months ago. The Venezuelan government closed the border crossings last August after three Venezuelan soldiers and one civilian were killed in a clash between smugglers and state security forces in a border area where criminals had infiltrated communities of legitimate Colombian refugees. Venezuelan authorities accused Colombian criminal organizations of using the porous jungle-covered border between the two countries to escape from Colombian authorities after perpetrating kidnappings for extortion and other serious crimes.
In addition, Venezuela said that the relatively open border crossings permitted criminals from both countries to smuggle state-subsidized staple goods, such as food and hygienic supplies, into Colombia, where they were sold for inflated prices in its thriving black markets. In the southern border city of Arauca, authorities noted that the closure of the San José Antonio Páez Bridge had reduced extortion, contraband, cattle rustling, and attacks against security forces by some 85%. Authorities in the Colombian border city of Cúcuta said that gasoline smuggling had decreased by 90%. In addition, local police said that there was a considerable reduction in crimes such as armed robbery and homicides. Although both nations have accused the other of responsibility for cross-border crime, Colombian authorities have noted an increase in common crime, such as cell phone and motorcycle robbery, apparently by local smugglers seeking an alternative to their lost income. There have been no reports of a corresponding increase in crime on the Venezuelan side of the border.
On March 2nd, in Geneva, Switzerland, the Venezuelan foreign minister, Delcy Rodríguez, asked the UN's Human Rights Council for a formal evaluation of an amnesty law that was recently passed by the newly elected right-wing majority in the Venezuelan National Assembly. Venezuelan Foreign Minister Rodríguez told the International Human Rights Monitoring Panel that the proposed law would violate the Venezuelan Constitution, which requires adjudication and punishment of human rights violations by freeing persons convicted of such crimes. According to Foreign Minister Rodríguez, the amnesty would free persons who were sentenced to prison for inciting violence and for various other crimes, including human rights violations.
Rodríguez told the 31st session of the UN Human Rights Council that the law, which was passed last month but which will not go into effect until after presidential and potential judicial review, was itself a human rights violation by proposing amnesty for such crimes. The Venezuelan foreign minister emphasized that the Maduro administration was promoting respect for human and civil rights through the expansion of educational and health services, as well as by promoting political inclusion and the eradication of poverty. The right-wing amnesty law would specifically release government opponents who are in prison for various crimes committed during violent anti-government protests that killed at least 43 persons, mostly government supporters, in 2014. The law has prompted widespread repudiation among Venezuelan popular and progressive sectors, who have also rejected various subsequent right-wing legislative initiatives, including a law that would privatize public housing for the poor. According to critics of the conservative proposals, the housing property law is an attempt to commodify over 1 million homes built by the state. Residents of the homes currently receive occupancy titles for life, but actual ownership remains with the state so that the houses can continue to serve the poor. The housing property law would grant ownership titles to the houses' residents, permitting them to sell the houses for any reason. Critics of the proposal note that poor people would likely be forced to sell their homes when facing financial difficulties, reducing them to homelessness and reducing.
On March 10th, members of the Tupac Amaru organization asked the Argentine Supreme Court to intervene in the case of the organization's jailed leader, Milagro Sala. In early March, the UN Group of Arbitrary Detention asked conservative Argentine President Mauricio Macri to explain why Sala, a popular grassroots leader, who is also a deputy to the South American Parliament, remains in jail 2 months after her arrest. The UN's group's request to President Macri came 2 weeks after Amnesty International and two prominent Argentine human and civil rights advocacy groups requested the UN group to intervene.
Sala, the leader of the Tupac Amaru broad-based grassroots alliance, was arrested on January 16th on charges that included sedition for a sit-in protesting the conservative policies of Jujuy State Governor Gerardo Morales. After widespread protests and a judge's ruling that Sala should be released pending trial, she was charged with additional crimes, including fraud in handling poverty program funding. Human rights organizations met with President Macri, a close ally of Jujuy State Governor Morales, to unsuccessfully advocate for Sala's release. President Obama's upcoming visit with the conservative Argentine president on the 40th anniversary of the military coup that started the dirty war against suspected leftists is expected to be the focus of the annual demonstrations that commemorate March 24th in Argentina as the Day of Remembrance for Truth and Justice.
This show was produced on March 14th, 2016.